of historical suffering that everybody must accept. That is the fuel which the far right uses to consolidate itself. But to buckle under it fearfully and unquestioningly, as many who think of themselves as liberal and left-wing do, is to disrespect this transformation too. Because in the politics of identity, there is all too often an important pivot, a hinge, which, when it turns upon itself, begins to reinforce as well as replicate the very thing it wishes to resist. That happens when identity is disaggregated and atomized into micro-categories. And even these micro-categories then develop a hierarchy and a micro-elite, usually located in big cities, big universities with social media capital, which eventually mimics the same kind of exclusion, erasure, and hierarchy that is being challenged in the first place. If we lock ourselves into the prison cells of the very labels and identities we have been given by those who have always had power over us, we can at best stage a prison revolt, not a revolution. And the prison guards will appear soon enough to restore order. In fact, they're already on their way. When we buy into a culture of proscription and censorship, eventually it is always the right and usually the status quo that benefits disproportionately.
You're listening to Arundhati Roy, India, on the Road to Theocracy. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
So I always say that along with free speech, we need fearless listening. We need to listen to things that we don't want to hear. Sealing ourselves into communities, religious and caste groups, ethnicities and genders, reducing and flattening our identities and pressing them into silos precludes solidarity. Ironically, that was and is the ultimate goal of the Hindu caste system in India. Divide people into a hierarchy of unbreachable compartments, and no one community will be able to feel the pain of another because they are in constant conflict. It works like a self-operating, intricate administrative surveillance machine in which society administers and surveils itself, and in the process ensures that the overarching structures of oppression remain in place. Everyone except those at the very top and the very bottom, and these categories are minutely graded too, is oppressed by someone and has someone to be oppressed by. Once this maze of tripwires has been laid, almost nobody can pass the test of purity and correctness. Certainly, almost nothing that was once thought of as good or great literature, not Shakespeare for sure, not Tolstoy, leave aside his Russian imperialism. Imagine presuming he could understand the mind of a woman called Anna Karenina. Not Dostoevsky, who only refers to older women as crones. By his standards, I'd qualify as one for sure, but I still like people to read him. Or if you like, try reading the collected works of Mahatma Gandhi. I can guarantee you that you'll be appalled on every count: race, sex, caste, class. Does that mean he should be banned or rewritten? Even Jane Austen wouldn't make the cut. It goes without saying that by these standards, every sacred book of every religion would not pass muster. Amidst the noise in public discourse, we are swiftly approaching a sort of intellectual gridlock. Solidarity can never be pristine. It should be challenged, analyzed, argued about, calibrated. By precluding it, we reinforce the very thing we claim to be fighting against. But what does all this do to literature? As a fiction writer, few things perturb me more than the word appropriation, which is one of the rallying calls of the new censorship. In this context, appropriation, crudely put, is about predators, even contrite predators, attempting to write or represent or speak over or actually tell the stories of their prey on their behalf. It's pretty skanky and a useful principle to keep in mind while critiquing something, but it's not a good reason to ban or censor things. Yes, the mic has been hogged. Yes, we've heard too much from one kind of people and too little from others. But the web of life is dense and intricate. Its creatures and their deeds cannot be essentialized and so easily and unintelligently catalogued. Coming specifically to fiction, there can be no fiction without appropriation, because we fiction writers are predators too. If serial killers are merciless sociopaths, novelists are merciless appropriators. To construct our fictional worlds, we appropriate everything that crosses our path and we put it all in play. That is what makes great novels dangerous and revelatory things. Speaking for myself, I have tried to learn my craft not only from politically irreproachable writers like Toni Morrison and James Baldwin, but also from imperialists like Kipling and from bigots, racists, troublemakers, and rascals who write beautifully. Should they now be rewritten to march to the beat of some narrow manifesto? The recent decision to re-edit the works of Roald Dahl, my God, who next? Nabokov? Shall Lolita vanish from our shelves? Or shall she be recast as an undercover preteen activist? Shall old masterpieces be repainted, shorn of the male gaze? It's so sad to even have to say all this. Where will it leave us? On a shore without footprints, in a world without history? If literature is going to be immobilized by this web of 1,000 snarling threads, it will turn into some sort of leaden, rigid manifesto. And sadly, those who are so enthusiastically involved in the policing aren't just petrifying others, they're petrifying themselves as well. They are laying landmines that they know they themselves will inevitably step on. In cagey, wary minds, there can be no dancing, only the heavy, cautious tread of this new language, new speak. In any case, driving things underground won't make them go away. If these debates could take place without the bullying and vindictiveness that accompany them, then most definitely, along with the usual mess of bigotry, racism, and sexism, there will be glorious new voices telling stories that have never been told before, putting much of the past to shame. But having said this, it's never a bad idea to pay close attention to words, because sometimes a word can signify a universe. For example, when I became a published novelist, on the occasions when I would speak outside India, I would more often than not be introduced on the stage as an Indian woman writer. In India, it would be the first Indian woman to win the Booker Prize. Each time it happened, I would wince inwardly and wonder at this way of labeling somebody. Was it necessary, or was it a way of limiting and circumscribing them? After all, it was literature we were talking about, not a visa application. I winced because I was constantly being lectured by privileged and entitled men, not just privately, but on the front pages of newspapers, about how to write, what tone to take, what topics would be suitable for a unspoken woman writer like me. Children's stories was a suggestion that came up frequently. The fiction didn't seem to bother them as much as the non-fiction, even if they agreed in principle with what I was saying. On one occasion, I was hauled up by the Supreme Court of India for contempt of court for my writing on big dams. During the trial, their lordships, the brother judges on the bench, would refer to me as that woman as they threw my essay around in exasperation, as if I wasn't standing there right in front of them. I'd refer to myself privately as the hooker that won the Booker. When I refused to apologize to the court, I was told that I wasn't behaving like a reasonable man and sent to prison for a day. Things have changed since then. Each of those words in that card index introduction of me, Indian woman writer, is these days the subject heading of some anxious and difficult interrogation, an almost irreconcilable conflict. Who is a woman? or indeed who is a human, what is a country, who is a citizen, and in the era of open AI and ChatGPT, who or what is a writer. We now know, even if many won't accept it, that the border between male and female is a fluid one and not what convention has assumed it to be. But what about the border between human being and machine, between art and coding, between artificial intelligence and human consciousness? Are those as hardwired as we thought they were? I mean, artificial intelligence, our natural intelligence has outstripped our instinct for survival. Now we want to outstrip our intelligence. The era of chatbots is here, and some are calling artificial intelligence the fourth industrial revolution. Will writers, journalists, artists, and composers now be phased out in the same way that weavers, craftsmen, factory workers, and old world farmers have been? Maybe like handcrafted and handwoven garments and artifacts, novels will return to be handwritten and sold as limited editions as works of art and not literature. Will literature be better produced by ChatGPT or Sydney or Bing? The great linguist Noam Chomsky thinks not. If I understand him correctly, he holds that a machine learning program can produce faux science or faux art by processing an almost infinite volume of data at high speed, but it can never replace the complex abilities of human instinct. There's a great deal of anxiety around what might happen if OpenAI finds its way into the world without regulations and guardrails, as there should be. When it comes to literature, my worry is less about whether chatbots will replace writers. Perhaps I'm a little too old and a little too vain for that. Or maybe it's just that I don't view literature as a product. The pain and the pleasure and the sheer insanity of the process is the only reason that I write. But my worry is that given the amount of data and information that human writers, see, I said it, human writers, have to process these days, and given the maze of tripwires we have to negotiate to be error-free and politically perfect, the danger is that writers may lose their instincts and turn into chatbots. Maybe then there'll be a transfer of souls. Then chatbots will appear to be real souls, and real souls will be chatbots pretending. In the midst of all this fluidity and porousness, the only borders that seem to be hardening are the borders between nation states. Those continue to be hardwired, patrolled. When they are breached by armies, we call it war. When they are breached by people, we call it a refugee crisis. When they are breached by unregulated movement of capital, we call it the free market. The modern nation state is right up there with God as an idea worth killing or dying for. But now, in the digital era, are we heading for a new kind of state, the electronic state, or what is being called a state in a smartphone, an avatar state, if you like. Funded by US aid and backed by big tech, Amazon, Apple, Google, Oracle, the avatar state is almost upon us. In 2019, the government of Ukraine launched DIA, a digital identification app for smartphones. In addition to providing more than 100 government services, DIA can house passports, vaccine certificates, and other ID. DIA City is its extraterritorial financial capital, a sort of venture capital hub where citizens can register and conduct businesses. After the Russian invasion began, DIA, initially conceived of as a bureaucratic tool to ensure transparency and efficiency, was, in the words of Samantha Power, administrator, USAID, repurposed for war. From all accounts, DIA has done a tremendous service to the brave people of Ukraine. It now has a 24/7 government news channel for citizens to update themselves on the war. Refugees can use it to register themselves and file compensation claims. Citizens can reportedly use it to upload information on collaborators and photographs of Russian troop movement, a sort of real-time public intelligence and surveillance network operated by ordinary citizens. When the war began, Ukrainian citizens' private data on DIA was transferred for safekeeping onto Amazon's military-grade hard drives called AWS Snowballs, the terrestrial equivalent of the cloud, and transported out of the Ukraine and uploaded to cloud. In a war as devastating as the one that Ukrainians are fighting and enduring, if a people are completely aligned behind their government, then having your state in a smartphone surely has incredible advantages. But do those advantages accrue in peacetime too? Because, as we know from Edward Snowden, surveillance is a two-way street. Our phones are our intimate enemies. They spy on us. In order to protect the democratic world, US aid plans to take DIA or its equivalent to other states. Countries like Ecuador, Zambia, the Dominican Republic are ahead of the queue. The worry is that once an app like DIA has been repurposed for war, can it be unpurposed or depurposed for peace? Can a weaponized citizenry be unweaponized? Can privatized data be unprivatized? India is quite far down this path too. During Modi's first term as Prime Minister, Reliance Industries, then India's largest corporation, launched Jio, a free wireless data network that came bundled together with a dirt-cheap smartphone. Once it had successfully muscled competition out of the market, it began to charge a small fee. Jio has turned India into the largest consumer of wireless data in the world, more than China and the US put together. By 2019, there were 300 million smartphone users. Along with the undeniable benefits of being connected to the internet, millions of people have become a ready-made audience for hateful, socially active, radioactive messaging and endless fake news that flows relentlessly into their phones through the social media. And it is here you will see India unadorned. It is here those calls for genocide and the mass rape of Muslims are identified, where videos of avenging Hindu warriors massacring Muslims and blaming Muslim fruit sellers for secretly spitting on fruit to spread COVID, like the Jews in Nazi Germany were accused of spreading typhus, are sent around to drive people into a frenzy of rage and hate. The Hindu supremacist social media channels are to the mainstream media what a vigilante media is to a conventional army. Militia can do things that are illegal for conventional armies to do. The digital revolution in India is a perfect example of how the interests of big business and Hindu supremacy coincide perfectly. As Indian citizens are ushered into the digital arena in their millions, entire lives are lived online. Education, medical care, business, banking, the distribution of food rations. And social media corporations have to be more and more attentive to the government that controls this huge market share. And when that government is unhappy, as it often is, it can shut down everything. We await the new 2023 Digital India Act, which gives the government unthinkable power over the internet. Already, India imposes more internet shutdowns than any other country in the world. In 2019, the 7 million citizens of Kashmir Valley were put under a blanket telecommunication and internet siege that lasted for months. No phone calls, no texts, no messages, no OTPs, no internet, and nobody around to drop a Starlink satellite for them. Today, even now, as we speak, Punjab with 27 million people has had its internet shut down because the government is hunting for a political fugitive. By 2026, India is projected to have 1 billion smartphone users. Imagine that volume of data in an India bespoke DIA app. Imagine all that data in the hands of private corporations. Or on the other hand, imagine it in the hands of a fascist state and its indoctrinated weaponized supporters. For example, say after passing a new citizenship law, country X manufactures millions of refugees out of its own citizenry. It can't deport them. It doesn't have the money to build prisons for all of them. But it can just switch them off. Country X won't need a gulag or concentration camps. It can switch the state off in their smartphones. It could then have a vast service population, virtually a subclass of labor, without rights, without minimum wages, voting rights, healthcare, or food rations. They wouldn't need to appear in books. It would improve country access statistical markers enormously. It could be quite an efficient and transparent operation. It could even look like a great democracy. What would a state like that smell like or taste like? Something unrecognizable or something very recognizable? Thank you for your patience. And for now, let me leave you with these thoughts. What is a country? What is a state? What is a human? And who or what is a writer? Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's hard to add much to this. Let me just ask one question. You're standing here very bravely talking about the state of your country. And at the same time, we hear people in the West speaking of India as a democracy. I mean, we've had this discussion in Sweden. We speak of Turkey as a democracy for political convenience. And I imagine something similar is going on now. There's a shift towards stopping China and so on. Is this very much part of what's going on, that the rest of the world just turns a blind eye to what's happening to Indian democracy because for political convenience?
So I am, in some ways, as a writer and as a person who believes that there are many of us who say that we may go down, but we'll never be on your side. And, you know, in those ways, I'm an idealist. But when it comes to understanding how the world works, I'm a complete cynic. Because I know that at all these summits and meetings, what I was saying here, you know, what is on sale in the free market? It's all these are things. Just to give you an example, last week, China brokered a deal, resolved the conflict, let's say, between Saudi Arabia and Iran. So now that's a huge shift in how power is going to work. You know, Iran, Saudi Arabia, China, Russia. So where does India come into play? India, you know, China's on India's border, inside India's border, but there's the Quad, you know, which is trying to use India to push back on China. But India can't say anything about Russia. There's nothing to do with morality. 90% of the weapons are from there. 90% of the servicing takes place there. Mm. All the oil is coming from there. There's huge, it's impossible. A nation of 1.4 billion people with intricate economic ties, you know. So now how are these things going to be engineered? If India shifts a little more than comfortably towards Russia, now it's playing both ways, then suddenly America will start talking about Kashmir. You know, this is how it is. It's not like anyone is genuinely concerned about human rights violations or, you know, I mean, if in any other country which wasn't a big market, if someone sat and watched the daylight slaughter of 2,000 people, wouldn't someone do something or say something? But no, because it's a huge market. So that's how it is. I mean, that's how international relations are. So we can't break our hearts over it, but we've got to understand it and not expect anything else. I don't.
Thank you so much.
You were just listening to Arundhati Roy, India on the Road to Theocracy. She spoke in Stockholm, Sweden in late March. Arundhati Roy is an internationally famous award-winning writer and global justice activist. Author of many books, her latest are Azadi and The Architecture of Modern Empire. To get copies of today's program, Arundhati Roy, India on the Road to Theocracy, and for her latest book, The Architecture of Modern Empire, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with sitar maestro Debu Chaudhary performing Raga Bhaga Shri. Thank you.
Ha huagestig ri CGSF, nachad poing aun FM, Crowley vo Burnaby, British Columbia.